Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for those 5-star reviews. And please keep it up.
Yeah, everybody, if it's your first time here, welcome. We know you're going to like what you got to hear today. After you like it, go back and follow us. Follow us on all the social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter. Not real big on the Twitter, but we've got some stuff. Facebook, everywhere. Just type in They Had to Go Out and you'll find us.
And if you're in New York town on Thursday, December 12th, we're going to be live down at the Liberty Lounge 2. That's a Thursday. You got to have a military ID to get on, but please come out. We've got a heck of a guest for you. I think everybody's going to have a good time. Also got a speaker coming from the Naval Institute Press to promote a couple of their essay contests and stuff that are open to a ton of people. They run a ton of different publications, whether it's history or policy you want to write about. It's going to be a good time, so come on out. And with that, today, who we have on the line? Retired Coast Guard Reserve Captain Stephen Craig, born and raised in Vancouver, Washington. Enlisted in the Coast Guard in 1972, went to boot camp in Alameda. Doesn't remember the company number. I can't believe it. That's our first. But once he graduated, went to Yeoman A School. And then first assignment was the Coast Guard Cutter Plane Tree, a buoy tender out in Honolulu. Did a few months there, went to Base Hano, then Barber's Point, Loran Station Kauai, and that pretty much summed up his first 4.5 years with the Coast Guard. He was on active service then, transitioned to the reserve, went to work in the civilian side with the post office. In the reserve, started out at Reserve Unit Tacoma, Washington, back when reserves were properly managed. but made a YNC there, and then went to Westport as a senior chief. We'll get into whether or not he was initiated here once we start talking to him.
Right.
But at Westport, he was there for about a year, got recommended to go to direct commission program, and was commissioned as a Lieutenant JG. Then went to the Reserve Unit Tacoma, Washington, on the inspection staff. In 1996, they eliminated the unit out in Tacoma. Everybody moved to Seattle to the Marine Safety Office. There they stood watch for pollution spills, ships aground, commercial ships aground, any of that. Then 9/11 happened, and he ended up being activated a total of 13 times in response to 9/11. Came back on duty a few times, running Portland continuity of operations. Did some time in Seattle, then Alameda. He's deployed to Hurricane Katrina. He was activated for Haiti port planning following the earthquake there. Activated for Deepwater Horizon. And also did kind of his twilight tour, it sounds like, in Hawaii, where he was a port security planner for the Coast Guard and worked on the APEC conference. retired back in January 2012, and has gone on to write three books, two of which are pretty Coast Guard related. But if anybody's wanted to travel to Italy, he did write an Italy travel and adventure book, and then also wrote Chronicles of Katrina, which were some of the letters that he wrote home while he was deployed there. And then the most recent one, and the one that you guys, if you're following Coast Guard on social media anywhere, have probably seen, All Present and Accounted For, about an incident on the Coast Guard cutter Jarvis. So with that, I think we've got a good guest today. I can't wait to hear the story.
It's a long and varied career, for sure.
It is. Retired as a captain, you know, came in as a non-rate, so doesn't happen often.
No.
But I will let Bill ask the question.
All right, Captain, welcome. And with that, the question is always, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, the one of, wasn't a very bright move on my part, but when I was on the plane tree, we went on a trip over the Big Island, and you know, I was based straight out of yeoman school, and it was dark out, and we hit a storm, and you know, being 19-year-old and being young and stupid, I decided to go out and see what it looked like, because I was from as a kid, grew up in Eastern Oregon over in Ontario, and I didn't know what a storm looked like, and so I went outside and closed the hatch and looked up to see the front of the ship disappear in a wave that knocked me down and threw me between the rails, you know, my feet hanging over the side there, and just I got up, you know, crawled back onto the deck there and went inside the hatch there and closed the door, you know, just dripping wet. And this chief came up to me and very eloquently asked me what I was doing outside, and he said, "You're not supposed to go outside at night in a storm." And I said, "Well, nobody told me that. I didn't know that." I mean, and like I said in the book, I said it was sort of a lesson learned that he didn't have to repeat to me. I think I learned my lesson on that one.
Yeah, some immediate feedback there.
Yeah, I could have been a trivia question for many decades, like whatever happened to Seaman Craig on the plane tree?
Just
he
gone.
Disappeared.
Right.
Yeah.
What was the plane tree, Mr. Craig?
It was a 180-foot buoy tender out of Honolulu at the time. Later on, it was sent up to Alaska, and it's probably sold for scrap since then. I know it's been decommissioned.
And you did what, like 5 months on that one, I think you said?
No, 45 days.
Oh, 45 days.
Yeah, I was only there for temporary assignment, and my permanent assignment was supposed to be back to the base.
When you almost fell over, they just kicked you off.
Right. That's what I'm guessing. We're done. This kid's no good to us.
I know when I talked to my detailer, I put 4.5 years in so I could make first class. And when I talked to the detailer, he was telling me that, he said, "Well, how much seat time do you have?" And I said, "Well, I got enough." And he says, "Well, our records here show 45 days. And I said, "Yeah, that's what I said."
enough.
And he said, "Well, we need a yeoman on board a high endurance cutter out of New York." And in those days, yeoman generally, you know, would work like 10, 12-hour days. We didn't have computers, and especially on the high-endurance cutters. And I said, "No, I don't think so." And he said, "Well, you don't have any choice." I said, "Yeah, I do. So I'll get out." So I got out for about a year, and I did miss Coast Guard. So I came back in as reservist because, you know, at the time, they never got recalled.
12-hour days.
I
don't know a single yeoman that does 12-hour days in the modern world.
They got computers now.
I'll give the yeoman some props. The ones I've had when I've been underway, the independent duty ones, now 10 of those 12 hours is waiting for the internet to load.
It's, fair enough.
There's 2 hours of actual work, but there's 10 hours waiting for the internet to load.
Yeah. Well, what about when you went to, so it says here you went to Loran Station Kauai, right?
Yeah.
Tell us about Loran Station Kauai.
Well, it was a Loran station. They called it a group office so they could get a yeoman over there. And basically all a group office was we had a small boat station, three people down there at the Willy Willy. And then we had a three-person at the lighthouse. And then we had about 15 guys at the Loran station itself, which is located on Poipu, which right now it's a bare piece of property. Hurricane Iniki, it was given to the state of Hawaii, and then Hurricane Iniki destroyed the buildings. So last time I checked a couple years ago, it was just an empty lot. But it was you know, we've been back a couple times, and the old property there is, they got these cliffs that overlook the water, and about a 30-foot drop, and you could sit up there with a Corona in your hand and watch the turtles as they swim by. So we would go out there and watch the sunset. But now, yeah, the last time I checked, it's still an empty lot. And it was next to the Embassy Hotel, I believe.
I always like hearing about these Lorraine sailors because, like, after that last one, I mean, that sounds like the best right. Lorraine station ever.
This
right?
one?
The,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this yeah. one was legit. The one before was kind of a little more remote.
Some island that yeah. was, like, they called it Tokyo's most distant suburb.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Unreal.
Yeah, it was somewhat quiet, you know. I mean, when you're 19 years old, there wasn't a whole lot to do, but drinking age in those days were 18 or 19 on Kauai anyway. So, but we, you know, I finished, I was going to the local college there, and, but, I mean, at least you could drive around. I had a Volkswagen Bug that I drove around, on the island with, and you'd go into Lahui and go to McDonald's or something, just something to do.
the big trip to McDonald's.
I almost said you were fully integrated until he's like, and then we went to McDonald's.
Right.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, I don't, I see why you got out after, of the active duty side after 4.5 years. I mean, your career couldn't have gotten better.
Right. Like, you're the second guy.
Yeah,
like
let's, why don't you go to a high endurance cutter in New York, and you'll never see New York because you'll be gone all the time. I don't blame you.
Yeah, I'm not hearing the second guy here very well.
Oh, okay, hold on. We'll fix him.
Okay. I know he's got some good comments. I don't want to miss him.
He really doesn't.
No, I don't have anything. I have nothing to add.
Yeah, don't believe that. But he was just saying that you had probably one of the best careers that he's heard of, so there was no reason to even stay in anymore.
Yeah, your active duty yeah. career could only go downhill after those first four.
Yeah, I put in about 38 years, and when you added up all the active duty time, I had close to 8 years of that was active duty. So, yeah, I have definitely no complaints about my career. I enjoyed it, obviously.
Did you make YNC while you were at the Lorraine station?
No, I was YN2, and actually after Lorraine station, I went to MIO Seattle at that time, and that's where I got off active duty in February '77. But when I got off active duty, I was a YN1, and then when I went back at reserves a year later, I was a YN1, and I don't know, within, you know, two to 4 years, I made chief.
Did you get initiated?
Down in, I was recalled for the 84 Olympics, and that's when I made chiefs.
Okay. Did you get initiated?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was in 84. How was that experience? I mean, I know you can't talk about it too much.
Tell people what you can tell them.
Yeah, tell us what you can tell us.
Tell us what?
Tell us what you can tell us.
It was interesting. I mean, it was packed because you know, you have the units there, and then there was a couple of other reserve chiefs that were down there too as well. But no, I mean, it was a ritual, and you know, make a chief is probably, you know, one of the high points of my life. So you know, it should be a time honored ritual to celebrate, and yeah, it was. I enjoyed, it was very rewarding.
Good. That's what I expected. That was a good, right, that was a solid answer, right?
Good answer.
Yeah, good answer. So, sir, you came back on. You've deployed to pretty much every emergency and disaster, I think, that was, you know, made the news.
Every hotspot.
What do you got from any of those? Whether it's Katrina, Deepwater, Haiti, any of it, Olympics.
It was when you get activated like that. I think each experience gives you more organizational skills on how to deal with situations. You know, life lessons. You know, you don't get excited. You just deal with the situation. You learn how to deal with the various situations, and you learn stuff on your own. I had one junior officer working for me that I think they sent him to work for me because they wanted to get rid of him out of the command. And
I never heard of that happening before.
No, wait, that's a thing?
That happens.
Yeah. But, you know, it's, he learned a lot and I learned a lot, and as far as having patience on my part, but we actually, the last day of his active duty, we went down to a local restaurant that he wanted to sit and talk on how he could improve as an officer, and he was a JG at the time, and so I was giving him some information basically on what he needed to do. But you know, you look back at my lesson learned was this was a guy who was basically had some challenges with society because he'd been basically raised with missionaries in Africa, so he never really had the ability to learn how to interact with people, and I probably needed to understand his background a little bit more in order to deal with him. And once I found out, you know, his challenges, I was better able to deal with him.
That's good.
Yeah, it's solid advice. That's that seek to understand, right?
Pardon?
I said that's that old saying. You try to seek to understand where somebody's coming from. Easy to say, hard to do.
Yeah, I had another guy working for me. I worked as a contractor for FEMA for 5 years, and I had one guy that came to Seattle to work for me, and he and I butted heads for about 2 weeks, and I finally said, you know, why can't you do what I'm telling you to do? And then I come to find out a couple days later that he was sent there with different orders on what his job was. And so we sat down. I said, what is your job? And he told me, and I said, no, that's not your job. This is your job. And he goes, well, I didn't know that. You know, so it's just better communication on my part, asking more questions. When he came in, I should have sat down with him and said, what is your job? Just make sure we were on the same page.
Yeah, well, let's talk about, so when you deployed to Katrina, where did you go down there?
The first place was Alexandria. I was there for 3 weeks, I guess, and then down New Orleans. And I wrote one time I was recalled for 2 months to write the evacuation plan for the state of Louisiana. They requested Coast Guard assistance to do that. And so we spent 2 months in Baton Rouge working out of the JFO there, which I sort of tell people that, being a comedian, that Baton Rouge, I say, you know what it means? And they say, yeah, French for red stick. I said, no, it isn't. It means nothing to do but eat and drink. there's not a lot to do in Baton Rouge, which probably explains why LSU football is such a religion down there. I've never seen, I thought Washington Huskies were rabid fans, but down Baton Rouge, it's insane down there. I give my hats off for how popular that football is down there. But that was I had 50 contractors working for me and 9 Coast Guard officers, and that was a very excellent experience. I was a senior officer,
What was the mission? What was your mission with the contractors and the staff?
We had to revisit, send contractors and Coast Guard people out and visit all the different parishes and get information, and then write an evacuation plan that FEMA could use to assist the state in evacuating people, you know, especially along the coastal areas. So our job was basically to write the plan and then submit it to the state.
So this was like post-Katrina to make sure something like that didn't happen again, basically?
Yeah, it was about 6 months after Katrina, or I don't know, maybe 9 months after Katrina.
Which is unreal, because you think about, like, the mass evac that happened anyway.
Right.
Like, and then within 9 months, everyone was back.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like, right.
There's some resiliency there, but some concerns, I'd say, too.
Well, there's a lot of lessons learned, and especially with my background in emergency management. I had a master's in emergency management, and so that background really helped me to, guide the efforts.
And then, you wrote a lot, right? You wrote a lot while you were deployed down there. What, what's kind of your most impactful letter that was published? I haven't read the book yet, but I'd be interested to hear which one was the most meaningful to you.
The Coast Guard gave me, because there's so much writing involved, especially as a senior officer, the Coast Guard gave me the skills to write. I'm not real sure of the question as far as the letter.
Just when you said the book, right, is like your chronicles of being down there. What's the first book? Right, the first book. Yeah. What was the what's your biggest takeaway? You know what? What's the hook, I guess?
Well, a lot of lessons learned. I put in the book, basically, I was sending out daily emails from each one of my visits, and there's five visits, and so there's a lot of emails. But basically, the book itself, as far as the most valuable part, is just the lessons learned on what we can do to be better prepared for the next disaster.
What were some of them, if you'll share them with us?
Be more prepared at home, and don't count on the government to always take care of you. It's probably one of the most important.
Hear, hear.
You know, people rely on the government, and you know you're going to be. It's not going to be a good situation if you're going to rely on the government. The government is not. It's not like Coast Guard where we'll be there in 5 minutes. I remember when I was stationed in Hawaii. You know, you had these fishermen say, "Well, if I get in trouble, I'll." Call the Coast Guard, and I said, well, you realize Coast Guard can't be there in 5 minutes. You know, you better have your flotation devices, radios, and all that. Some people have this perception, you just call the Coast Guard and they'll be there in 5 minutes.
Right. It took you 5 days to steam there. How quick do you think the Coast Guard's going to get there?
Right.
Yeah. So, people, the most important thing that out of that first book was people just have to be better prepared. Katrina really showed the lack of preparedness, and it showed how some people in some neighborhoods were totally prepared. They had radios, they had food and water, and they protected their neighborhoods. So you could use that as both sides. One example was the aquarium that was down there. I went down there, and they wanted to see if Coast Guard could use that as an alternate coop site. Because they had some problems with people stealing when they were closed down.
Were you like, yeah, put my desk right in the, like...
Right in front of the shark tank.
Yeah, right in front of the shark tank so I can watch them swim around all day.
Yeah, in case that thing breaks.
Right.
But they had some burglary problems, and they figured that, you know, with the Coast Guard reputation, if the Coast Guard was there, nothing would get stolen. And but what was interesting was about them was they had a generator that was guaranteed to operate for 3 days. And it quit after, I think it was 30 hours or whatever. And the director said, you know, these guarantees don't mean anything if they don't work. You know, we lost all our fish. You know, it's $2 million worth of fish. And even though those generators guaranteed, that doesn't mean it's going to work. And that was an interesting lesson right there.
What about any lessons for the responders? We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
They need to probably make sure that their families are prepared. You know, that they're going to have to go out and respond, and it's a little bit hard to respond when you're worried about your family. So you got to make sure your families are better prepared. Make sure you have contact numbers, like an out-of-area phone number. You know, if something happens in Louisiana, maybe you should have a relative in Idaho that you can call, because I don't know if things changed, but back in those days, the local area code, you couldn't call because it was overflowing, you know, with the calls. So, but you could call a different area code. So just have arrangements with your family on who to contact. But, you know, you don't know, maybe your wife's going to be shopping. She needs to tell everybody she's okay.
Right.
Right.
No, that's a very good point, because that's usually the one thing that'll pull somebody out of service pretty quick, right, is when their thoughts and their mind are with their family, because they don't know.
Yeah, and we had, you know, we had cases down there in Louisiana following Katrina where some of the responders were also victims. I had one guy working for me, and well, he was active duty, he was working for this other commander, but he was telling me, I asked him how he's doing, because he said, I'll tell you how I'm doing. He says, I was only here 2 days. I've only been here 2 days. All my household goods were in the house. We haven't even unpacked, and the floods hit, and I've lost everything. Everything was destroyed. He says, so my wife had to relocate 100 miles away. He says, and I have this other supervisor, you know, because I told him, I said, I need to get closer to my family. And his other supervisor said, he says, you know, well, you just got to suck it up. And so I went to this minister. We had all kinds of religious help there, and I told him, I said, you need to do something to help this guy out. And so I came back 2 months later, and the guy's still there. And by then, I'm thinking to myself, I think he's, you know, starting to lose it. And because I asked him again how he was doing, and he said, it's not better. You know, in my family, I haven't seen my wife in 3 weeks, whatever. And so I told the minister, I said, you got to do something about it, help this guy out. And he said, well, you know, he hem-hawed, and I said, look, I think the guy is ready to explode. I said, you got to help him out. And anyway, the long and short is he did. He got the guy transferred closer to where his family was, and so things are a lot better for that family. But sometimes, especially when people are not affected, they think everybody can just suck it up. It's not that easy, you know, when all your household goods have been destroyed and your family's not nearby and you've got all that stuff going on. It's just not that easy.
Yeah, and even the guys, yeah, sure, even the ones that can suck it up, there's definitely a time limit on that, right? There's the kind of the in extremis part where a lot of people power through, and then there's the back end of that where it really starts to impact them.
Yeah, and that reminds me, you know, going to leadership school, you know, long time ago, you know, we were required to see that movie 12 O'Clock High, you know, and that, yep, was a good example where the commanding officer basically lost it toward the end there.
I gotta watch that movie. I don't know if I've seen it.
They still show it in LEMS. I remember way back when I was a third going to LEMS, they still show that. Yeah.
All my leadership's learned on the job.
Yeah, great movie.
Yeah, it really is. I watched it with my son the other night, actually.
Did he?
Yeah, we really did. It's on Netflix. It's Netflix or Amazon Prime. It was on.
I watched McClinic yesterday.
Never seen it.
Yeah, it's John Wayne.
Ah.
Just throwing it out there. Mr. Craig, what? So, tell me about this one. You know, the activated for the Haiti earthquake, right? What was your role? And yeah, just so what was your role? I guess.
I worked in the Virginia office, and I would have to make daily phone calls to our Coast Guard rep that was on scene. He's full captain. I can't remember his name, but he was down there to help with the port recovery planning, and he'd give daily reports on their status and meeting with the port reps and what they needed down there. And basically my job was just pass the communication, talk to him, see if there's anything he needed. And I know when he first got down there, I think they were sleeping on top of a deck of a Coast Guard boat because there was no berthing available. And then later they got berthing, I believe, on board a Navy ship. For some reason, I'm thinking the name was Captain White or something like that. But that was a very interesting job, and just to get the daily communication and seeing the current status was pretty interesting.
Yeah, you're kind of like the fixer almost, right? Like, right. Is that basically what your role was, you would say?
Might have to find out what they need and then take steps and make sure it communicated up the chain that, you know, what they needed down there.
Right.
But it was a very bad situation. I remember him telling me that they had Navy divers were going in the water to try to do repairs on the docks, and the waters down there were like full of chemicals. And then a problem they were starting to have a lot of is some of the local people, to get rid of bodies, they just drop them into the bay there. And so these Navy divers were not only having problems with the chemicals, but also dead bodies floating in the water.
Yeah, that's not something you want to see.
Well, I was going to say, and that's just, I mean, Haiti in general, like going in the water would be a concern, I think.
Yeah.
Well, tell us, so you've written a new book. I'm curious about this new book because the cover definitely caught my eye. What's it about?
It's about the Coast Guard cutter Jarvis grounding and near sinking in November 1972 up there in the Bering Sea. I first learned of this story in 73 when I was a E-4 pay officer down there at Base Honolulu, and I ran across one of the crew members, and it was only about maybe 6-9 months afterwards. And this crew member, he was probably about 19 and I was about 19, and he was telling me that the story about how it nearly sank up there, and he's telling me about how they had a prayer vigil up there with Captain Woolley. And things had gotten so bleak up there where they held hands and they were praying out there on the deck. And he's telling me that, he said there was no panic, but he says if anybody tells you that they weren't afraid, they're lying to you. He says there was a lot of fear that the ship would sink or crash on the rocks. And that was a similar feeling I got. I talked to, I don't know, 30, 35 of the former crew members I could find, and that was a similar sentiment I had from all of them as far as during the ordeal. But it was it's taken me close to 2 years research from start to where we are today. And I did I found some people through Facebook and some of the crew members through some other people search websites. And plus I got the original ship logs from San Bruno. And then later I got hold of the board investigation on the incident as well. But it was, I retired fully January of 2018 and started writing a magazine article, and the thing just sort of exploded on me. Because it was such a big story. And one thing I feel like I owe to the crew members is to tell their story, because a lot of them feel like the story should have been told, but it never was. And when the Jarvis finally limped back into Honolulu, it was also the transfer season, and so a lot of guys, they never had a chance to sit down and go over lessons learned or find out what anybody else did. And so a lot of these guys are looking forward to my book just to see what was going on, you know, in the engine room or on the deck or with Coast Guard Aviation in the air. And I managed to put it all together so that they can see what was going on.
So they grounded in the Bering Sea and then limped all the way back to Hano?
They grounded and they thought they had it fixed. This went over a day. And the next day the decision was made against some other recommendations to go ahead and try to make it back to Honolulu. And when they got out in open water, the XO had written in his story that they encountered the most tremendous seas he had ever seen. And it swamped the boat, the patch broke off, they flooded the engine room with 13 feet of water. And of course, you get that much water, it disabled the engine, so now they were just floating powerless. And they were floating toward Akutan Island, and the side of the island that they were floating toward was all rocks. And so they knew that if they hit that it would destroy the ship, and they would probably lose everybody due to the waves and the cold. Same time, you know, you got these winds going on and snow and ice and you know, huge seas that were swamping the boat. It got pretty intense. And then one of the things, when they finally had to send out an SOS, because Coast Guard didn't have any assets in the area, and there was a Coast Guard, a Japanese fishing trawler that was in the area, somewhat in the area, and they said they could get there in about an hour, I believe. And the problem was the officers on board had figured out that they were going to hit the shore in about 30 minutes. And so the Jarvis crew, they basically had to rig up some systems to try to slow the vessel down, and then the Japanese trawler hauled ass to get there in time.
Okay. Wow. Unreal. Yeah, I was kind of wondering, like, what drew you to the story, but I think that just that pretty well explained it, right?
Yeah, I mean, until I heard of your book, I had never heard this story, and that sounds like one we should probably tell.
Yeah, I mean, anytime a 378 sends an SOS,
right?
things got serious.
Well, I remember there's a guy that another postmaster, and he retired just like me, but he was telling me he was a Coast Guard radioman up there in Alaska. And he remembers going into the radio room and somebody said, "Hey, we just got an SOS from the Jarvis." And he said, "Well, what ship is in danger?" And the guy says, "No, you don't understand." He says, "It is the Jarvis that's in danger." And so that definitely caught his attention. The Coast Guard threw everything he could at the problem. And I probably didn't capture everything. But after the book was sent up to the publisher, a Coast Guard pilot got hold of me who flew one of the C-130s, and he had even written a paper about it, and he sent it to me. So I contacted the publisher, and I got the C-130 story put in there too. And then some other guys on Facebook, they were on a different C-130, and both times the one C-130 got struck by lightning while it was dropping off a load onto the Jarvis, put a hole in their wing, and then blew out their sonar dome. And it's pretty, the pilot's story on that was pretty gripping. And then the crewman on another plane was talking about how both pilots came down with vertigo and they had to basically fly straight for a while until both pilots recovered. But it was lightning and thunder and dark clouds, and, you know, it was dark as hell out there too. So it was pretty suspenseful, the whole thing.
Yeah, you know what's the coolest thing about that, though, is that, you know, these guys, all of us, I think, would just throw yourself at that problem.
Right.
Like you said, you know what I mean? Like, I doubt there was any doubt in anyone's mind that, hey, we got a SOS from the Jarvis, we're gonna make that right.
Right.
Yeah.
So, cool, awesome to hear.
Yeah, I got a seven-page newsletter on the helicopter pilot. Plus, talking to Chief Stanswick was in charge of the deck force there, but they're a pretty gripping story about that. They had a helo on board the ship, and they decided that they had to fly off the ship, or else they were going to dump the helo into the ocean. And it was a pretty gripping story on how they got the helo off the ship. In fact, a couple of crew members had remarked, and I didn't put their names in the book, that they had secretly taken bets that the helicopter wouldn't make it.
No, but I'm sure, they weren't the only two.
I forgot to put their names in the book. But the pilot told Chief Stanwyck, I believe, that he was going to fly his crew off the ship. And he says he was going to come back and start evacuating the crew because they couldn't get the lifeboats off. And some of the crew members basically felt like the lifeboats was a death sentence. A couple of them refused. They said, "No, we're not going in those boats. We'll go down with the ship." But he told Chief Stanwyck, he says, "You know, as soon as I drop them off, I'll come back, start evacuating." He says, "And I'll evacuate until I run out of fuel." So it was a pretty amazing story.
Yeah, that is awesome.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I love that you heard, like, the rumblings of it, you know, three decades ago, and it sparked enough interest for you to write about it so that now we can all share in it.
Yeah, I look forward to being able to learn the whole story.
Yeah, I just think it's a great story, and I've got a lot of the quotes from the actual crew members themselves. There was one guy, he was an E4. He retired as a commander, but he gave me a whole ton of stuff. On the negative side, I got two of the crew members that gave me a good amount of stuff. They passed away in the last year. I sort of felt bad about that. One guy had given me a whole ton of stuff, and he had actually written the first Jarvis log story. Last time I talked to him on the phone, he says, "Yeah, I got some health issues, but, you know," he said, "I'm slowly rebounding." And the next thing I know, I was reading his obituary.
You recorded those words, and that story will play into, hopefully, people making better decisions going forward.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, I've also, one thing I've done, I put the board investigation in there, and, you know, the captain was relieved of command, and but I try not to put opinion in the book. I put basically just facts. People can read the book and they can decide whether the captain should have been relieved or not. But I, you know, that generally comes with territory. You know, you sink, you almost sink your ship. You're relieved of command. But one thing it did,
anyway.
Yeah, one thing. There were very few awards given. You know, one of the crew members, and of course these crew members, you know, they were E4s in. Now today they're like 65 years old or whatever. You know,
right?
One guy says, you know, we did save the ship. We should have got something. You know, and they also, you know, when the ship finally made it back Dutch Harbor, they basically had to clean out the engine room, which was, one guy says, you know, we went in there, and when we came out, we were all just oily black from all the oil and chemicals and stuff, and we'd have to work in there, that crap, they called it elephant snot. They had to work in that stuff for, you know, like 10-hour days to clean out the engine.
Yes, I mean, terrible yeah. place to be, but hey, so if we don't do it, she's going down, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, and they had to clean out the engine so they could limp back to Honolulu.
Right.
And then they were escorted back to Honolulu by the Winona and a couple of other ships that participated. One of the amusing stories that I heard was when they finally made it into the Honolulu, the port there wanted to tow the Jarvis up to the dock, and Captain Woolley said, no, we'll make it on our own, you know, sort of a pride thing. And so these I think a couple of the tugboats showed up, and they threw their lines on board the Jarvis, and the crew members would kick the lines off back into the water, and then the Honolulu pilot came on board, and Chief Stanzik was telling me that he had these two guys, these two seamen that were basically like bodybuilders, you know. They told the chief, you know, hey, we'll take care of the pilot for you. And he says, yeah, go ahead. And then Chief Stanzik got thinking, wait a minute, those guys never volunteer for anything.
Right.
And so he goes running back, and they had grabbed the pilot, and they were getting ready to throw him overboard. And so Chief advised him of the errors of the way.
I was kidding.
But yeah, there was a couple guys I wanted to get hold of. I never did find them. And then there was the corpsman, who was also Captain Woolley's friend. He had followed him from another ship. I couldn't find him because I knew he had some good information. And then after the book's all printed and ready to go here, I get a text from him. He was on Facebook, but he had a common name. It was impossible to locate him. But it would have been interesting to get his information in there, but a little bit too late.
And what do you think, you know, for anybody that does pick up the book, what do you hope they take away from it?
What these guys went through. I don't know if enough credit's been given to the crew on what they did to save the ship. It was about as bad working conditions as you could possibly imagine. You know, these guys are out on the deck. They could see their breath. One guy was working in the engine room, and there's sparks flying from the electrical panel. And he said the water was so cold that he cut his hand, and it was bleeding all the place. So he said he stuck his hand into the cold water, and his bleeding stopped. You know, but it was just the working conditions that they went through to save the ship's just phenomenal. I don't think enough credit's been given to them for what they did.
Yeah,
there were some awards
under that
given.
Level of stress, right?
Right.
Yeah, there were some awards given, but the whole picture of what they went through. And the start of the book, I start with the history of David Jarvis. The first chapter is just basically the history of David Jarvis, and because I figured he needed a little bit of background on how the Jarvis was named.
No, I think I am literally stoked to read this book.
Yeah,
it's one of the ones that I never heard about. Well, Captain Craig, where could people find the book?
Well, right now it's on the paperback version is on Barnes & Noble, Amazon. Hellgate Press is the publisher, and you can buy direct from them. It's a couple bucks cheaper through them. I've got a bunch of books ordered for myself. The hardback copy should be coming out soon. They're supposed to prove the proof today or tomorrow. That one, for some reason, taking a little longer. I've got a lot of people that want to get autographed copies from me. I think my list is about 100 names right now.
What if somebody requests an autographed copy, where can they do that?
They can go to my website. It's www.stephenjcraigbooks.com. They can send an email there or an email directly to me, which is scraig7002@gmail.com, and I'll put them on the list. I'll probably they can either pay by check or they can go through PayPal, which is a simple system. You just go to PayPal and then you enter my email address, and I think you enter your Visa. I think that's all it is to do it. But I don't know the cost yet. Soft cover is Hellgate Press is like $16.95. Barnes and Noble seems to be about a dollar more, and Amazon's a couple bucks more.
Don't talk to me about PayPal. Bill can attest.
That's a whole other episode.
Yeah, hey, if you're doing business through PayPal, I just throwing it out there. Find a different way. But I'll share my story with you when we're off here.
Yeah, you need to send me an email on that one.
Yeah, I'll let you know all about PayPal. Interesting business model those guys have. Well, hey, Captain Craig, we so much appreciate your time today. I really look forward to reading the book. I know that myself and the nation appreciate your service, especially in all the events that you were involved in. I mean, being activated 13 times post 9/11, Deepwater Horizon, the Haiti earthquake, Katrina. What an awesome career, and truly thank you for your service.
Well, thank you, and you know, the Coast Guard made me what I am today. Yeah, you know, the book wouldn't have been written without, you know, the background and the training the Coast Guard's given me.
Awesome. Well, hey, we really appreciate it. Guys, go out there and look at Captain Craig's book. Again, it's All Present and Accounted For. Sounds like it's available on every outlet. And StephenJCraigBooks.com.
Yeah, Captain, thank you for your time today. That was great. And what a crazy story.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks, sir. All right. Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.